the locals were disgusted by handkerchiefs. Quote, "They say we place what is unclean in a fine white piece of linen and put it away in our pockets as something very precious while they throw it upon the ground." I have to say, I'm kind of with the Indians on that one. Welcome to Everyday Abundance, the podcast that explores the hidden histories behind everyday activities and technologies you didn't even know were technologies. Hi, I'm Virginia Postrell.
I'm Charles C. Mann.
In this episode, we talk about dealing with a problem that pretty much everyone faces: blowing your nose. Whether you're a snot-nosed kid or an allergy-plagued adult, eventually you have to figure out what to do with all that excess mucus. And different people over time have dealt with it in different ways. Back in the 15th century, the then sort of celebrity humanist intellectual Erasmus wrote a book that translates Civilized Manners for Children. So we're going to make those little brats into civilized people. One of his pieces of advice was, don't go around with a snot-filled nose like some grubby person. And he advises his readers that Socrates was criticized for this.
And it's well known. There's entire chapters of Plato, right? That are devoted to.
I have no idea how Erasmus knew that Socrates.
Like kind of a drive-by shooting. Just, you know, out of nowhere, Socrates is getting laid
well,
waste.
Well, it's also, you know, Erasmus, very well-read humanist, revealing how he knows his Plato. He also advised people not to wipe their snot-filled noses on their clothes or on their hand if they were just going to then turn around and wipe it on their clothes. He advised them to use a handkerchief like a civilized, well-mannered person. And that was the civilized, well-mannered thing to do in Europe. Now, elsewhere across the Atlantic, people had other ideas. In his wonderful book, 1491, Charles quotes an account of a Jesuit missionary in the early days of the European encounter who reported that the locals were disgusted by handkerchiefs. Quote, "They say we place what is unclean in a fine white piece of linen and put it away in our pockets as something very precious while they throw it upon the ground." I have to say, I'm kind of with the Indians on that one.
I just thought this, like, you're like taking this stuff and shoving it into your clothes? Like, what's wrong with you?
And it's really nice cloth, fine white linen. So this is what was going on in the 15th century. Erasmus in Europe telling kids, don't go around with a snot-filled nose and don't wipe it on your clothes. And the native peoples in New England saying, ooh, look at these Europeans with their disgusting handkerchiefs. Fast forward to the period we're mostly going to be discussing today, which is the period in the 19th century where the Industrial Revolution has made handkerchiefs both more necessary and more abundant.
In the mid-1990s, I went to China for one of the first times that I'd been there, and I went to the Northwest, which was the coal mining, coal using center of China at the time. But I realized subsequently this was a remnant of what many, many places had been like in the 19th century when the Industrial Revolution is getting vast amounts of coal smoke in the air. I went with a friend and we saw all kinds of interesting things. And our first day there, we made a shocking discovery, which is there weren't really hotels because people didn't go there for that kind of thing. We were idiots. And fortunately, my friend spoke Chinese, and so we met people, and a guy said, I can solve your problem, and he slipped us into a factory dormitory.
Right.
So in those days, they would have workers from the countryside come there and stay and live for long periods of time in these dormitories and work in the factories. And there was an extra couple beds, and people were great. We learned lots of stuff. We were incredibly nice. And the next morning, we went and we took our shower in this kind of dingy communal shower for all the factory workers. And that morning, there was this absolutely incredible symphony of nose blowing and expectoration and spitting from all the dirty coal smoke air that had been there, that had been saved up. And there's this just explosion of going. It was absolutely extraordinary, like nothing I'd ever seen. And there was this trough down the both sides of this long rectangular room, and floating in this trough was the noisome results.
Not only mucus, it's sort of gray and icky from horrible. The coal smoke.
It was horrible, and this unwholesome river is flowing down there. And I was like, whoa, okay, this is a serious mucus management problem. And I subsequently learned that what I was seeing was actually something actually quite ancient, because in East Asian cultures, blowing your nose in public is something you just don't do. It's quite rude. So all these people were getting rid of everything that they could possibly get rid of, so they could go out into public and do their thing.
Communal shower doesn't count as public.
Yeah, exactly. This has been going on for so long that, this whole, you find ancient etiquette books saying what you do is you sniff it up and keep it going until you go privately.
Right. And this is also one, not the only reason, but that people in East Asia, when they have a cold, will wear a mask.
Right.
Because it makes it a little easier to hide that your nose is running.
Right. During the Industrial Revolution, not only do you have all this dirty air like you had in China in the coal growing areas that I talked about, but you also have a dread disease.
Right. So two things are happening in this period.
Right.
One is lots of coal smoke.
Right.
So even people who are perfectly healthy, we might say, are going to have reactions to that, are going to cough. So an earlier version of what you saw in coal country in China. The other thing that happens as people are crowding into cities, you get the spread of tuberculosis, which is a very serious respiratory disease that can kill you.
I mean, it really does kill you.
It's very contagious.
Archaeologists go back and they look at the teeth of, people who died in this period, and the dental plaque, you can see their disease. And, there's things like they'll go to a London graveyard and exhume 100 bodies, and 50 of them will show evidence of tuberculosis, which is pretty symptomatic if it shows up here. And there's these estimates, I don't know where they come from, but they're widely cited, that up to 90% of people in places like New York at the time were infected with tuberculosis. And the point's not that that's so much true, but it gives you some idea of how prevalent it was that it possibly could be true. And at least a quarter of the people who died during that time, the leading cause of death in urban culture, were dying of tuberculosis.
Right, right. In the U.S., it was like the number one, certainly, infectious disease killer.
Right, right. And in London, in the late 19th century, one out of every four people who died from TB.
And there's a whole romantic literature around consumption, which is tuberculosis.
Right.
It becomes weirdly valorized. In some cases, that's because John Keats, romantic poets, die young of tuberculosis, which is this kind of, aside from the lung disease, sort of a wasting disease.
So you waste away attractively because you're pale, maybe you have flushed cheeks.
And the sign that somebody has, a sign that somebody's probably has tuberculosis, is that when they cough into their handkerchief, instead of it just being snot or mucus or whatever, blood is there.
And there's innumerable Victorian romances where, a plot development, meaning, this character is about to exit the stage for dying, is signified where they suddenly whip out the handkerchief and, oh no, blood appears.
Right. Yeah. And probably the most famous tubercular romantic protagonist is Camille, who is a courtesan in Paris. And, it's a whole plot, but she dies of tuberculosis.
Attractively.
Attractively. So this is part of the culture. So, the Industrial Revolution made handkerchiefs more necessary, but also more common.
Right.
So the 19th century is this period of handkerchief abundance. The Industrial Revolution starts with spinning machines in the late 18th century. Mechanized spinning of thread, or sometimes called yarn, to be woven into cloth. And this vastly increases the supply of textiles. And maybe 25 years later, you get power looms. And so textiles are really more abundant, and that includes handkerchiefs. So if you take a man's handkerchief, it would have been about 15 inches square.
So Virginia is actually if you're just listening, holding up a handkerchief. And I am happy to say that it has my initial on it.
We'll get to initials later. So, yes. So man's handkerchief, 15 inches square, would have required about a half a mile of thread.
Is it like super tightly packed? Because, you know, I'm envisioning this thing that has to hold something gooey and awful without it, you know, slipping through.
Right. It's pretty tightly packed. It's not as tightly packed as I would have guessed.
So is this like something you have on display, but if you use it, you quickly replace it with another one?
So handkerchiefs are used in multiple ways. They are part of your wardrobe, and especially for women, they're often, you can't even imagine blowing your nose on it. They would have a lot of lace, and I'm holding up a similar one.
Right.
They would have a lot of lace. It'd be very fine, but you could dab your nose with
okay.
it.
Okay, but so if a woman starts crying or something,
a man that, might it, give
am
her.
I'm supposed to give her?
Give her, right. You might give her your handkerchief.
Which is more functional.
Yeah. So handkerchiefs are a big business. They're one of the things that people make with this abundance of thread, and because people buy a lot of them, and they're available at every price point. There are cheap handkerchiefs and very luxurious handkerchiefs. They're handkerchiefs made of linen, cotton, and silk.
I vaguely have these memories of things reading about Beau Brummel and these dandies and so forth, and they have like many, many handkerchiefs.
People would have owned, even people were not Beau Brummel, who was a famous dandy, would have owned multiple handkerchiefs, and they would have been part of the laundry, would have been.
Right. So we're not talking about multiple, we're not talking about like three.
It would depend on how rich you were.
Oh, okay.
It's like everything else in life.
Right. So if I'm an upper middle class person,
you probably would have owned at least a dozen.
Wow. Okay.
And they were sold. If you went to a department store, and this is the 19th century, is not only the rise of all these big industrial things and railroads, et cetera, it's also the rise of department stores. You start to have these giant shopping emporia. Mm-hmm. You go into the department store on the first floor, there would almost always be a big handkerchief department right in front. The way if you go into, there are a few remaining department stores now. If you go into them today, into like a Macy's or something, you'll have all the cosmetic counters on the first floor because it pulls people in, and I don't know.
So this is a draw.
So it's a draw. You have these big handkerchief departments. They have handkerchiefs for women and men. If you look at old department store ads, they will often feature what are their offerings in handkerchiefs.
Now, is there like fashions? Is it just that there's such a demand for them that people are just buying them all the time?
Well, it's both. You need them to blow your nose in this coal-filled air, and they are also they can also be decorative, not only with lace, but they might be printed mm-hmm. with, you know, you might get a women's handkerchief and they would have a bouquet of flowers that would be printed right. on it. And you could still use it to blow your nose, but it would also be something pretty that you might. And of course, there are other practical uses for handkerchiefs, particularly a bandana is a form of a handkerchief. And you might, if you were working outside and even today, you know, you might tie it around your neck or around your head or something. So they're not just used for blowing your nose, but that's the main, or dabbing your tears or dabbing your nose. You also have, both before and after the Industrial Revolution, yeah. textiles in general, but particularly handkerchiefs mm-hmm. as things to steal. And in Oliver Twist, there's this
right. Fagin,
gang yeah. of little pickpockets. A lot of what they steal is handkerchiefs. And they're doing sort of pickpockety kind of stealing.
So but, they're stealing people's handkerchiefs, not from the store, but from...
Right. They're stealing them from people because everybody's got one.
Right.
And you know, there's a good resale market. And people would also steal handkerchiefs and things made of textiles and general clothes and stuff off of right. clotheslines where they were hanging to dry. And I'm sure there was shoplifting also.
Right.
I mean, this is the period where... With the rise of department stores comes the rise of a category of theft called shoplifting.
Right.
I mean, people always stole from market stalls yeah, and right. such, but basically middle-class women stealing in department stores, which is different. I mean, most shoplifting in the past was associated with poor people.
Right.
Either they were shoplifting because they needed the stuff, they
right.
needed food or whatever, or they were kind of like Fagan's gang making a living as thieves.
Right.
In the 19th century department stores, you get shoplifting by respectable women who are just overtaken by the abundance of stuff and they want more of it.
Yeah.
That they can afford to buy some of it, but they want more of it than they can afford, or they just can't control themselves. I mean, this is where the idea of kleptomania comes
really?
In. Yes.
There's a period of time in the 19th century where women are constantly being diagnosed with, you know, hysteria and all this. And kleptomania is one of them.
And part of it is the department stores usually don't want to bring charges because they want to sort of keep it quiet.
Yeah.
And women don't want. Now, one thing you can do is you can just tell the husband, and that can be a form of discipline. But the other thing that happens is you start to get store detectives, and some of the detectives are women because
right.
they can better surveil.
I had no idea that there was a plague that's female shoplifters.
There's actually quite a good book, which I think is somebody's dissertation, essentially, called "When Ladies Come a Thieving." But anyway, so. Handkerchiefs are this big business.
Right, the handkerchief industrial complex.
Yes, exactly. And it's really important to retailers. Again, every price point, the ones that are serving the, you know, the fresh off the boat immigrants
right.
to the ones that are serving the people with giant homes in the country,
right.
they all have handkerchiefs. They're really great gift items.
What do you give the person who has everything?
They can always use another handkerchief. One of the popular gift items is a monogrammed handkerchief.
Right.
Although we're in an era where the cloth is made on machines in factories, the embroidery is probably done by hand, almost certainly done by hand, because this is a really long time before computerized embroidery machines. So this handkerchief that I have here has a label on it still. And this is probably from the 20s or 30s, not all the way back in the 19th century, but it says it was hand embroidered, and then it says hand rolled in the Philippines. And that is the process of rolling the edges and then whipping them, doing what's called
a
whip stitch.
Like a big flip over, but this
a tiny little roll. So you get a really fine edge, and that's the hem. That in the 19th century, or the late 19th, early 20th century, there are a lot of female reporters, sometimes called stunt reporters. They do things. They go around the world in 80 days. Nellie Bly was the most famous one. She went undercover in a madhouse.
So part of it is that a woman is doing this.
A frisson is that a woman is doing this. And a lot of women have gone into journalism in this period. It is a field that is open to women up to a point, partly because newspapers have women's pages because they want to have female readers. In 1907, a journalist called Rita Child Dorr went undercover in the handkerchief department at Christmas.
Ripping the lid.
She got a job in a department store that served a kind of working middle class. It turned out she got a job in the handkerchief department. She did well on the first day, apparently. She was completely exhausted. And these were very long days, like 12-hour days. The second day, she sort of got a promotion. No additional money, but she got assigned to the area where she was selling the pre-embroidered initial handkerchiefs. And she writes about what a madhouse it was. She says, "It was my duty in the intervals of selling, that is, on those in the slow moments, which were few and far between, to keep that counter full of loose handkerchiefs in neat and attractive piles according to initial. I am sure I arranged them at least 100 times in the course of the day, all the G's together, all the J's, the M's, the D's, and the rest of the alphabet. The utter futility of trying to keep them in proper order and the patent necessity of doing so, because you want the people to be able to find what they're looking for, if they were to be disposed of, i.e. sold, caused me so much effort and emotion. Hardly would I get the first four letters arranged when hands would swoop down on the next piles and scatter them broadcast." She says that they had every letter in the alphabet, and they may very well have. I have also found a Sears ad from a few years before that, where they're advertising super bargain handkerchief that would amount to, in today's dollars, about $4.48 each. They don't have the initials I-O-Q-U-E. UVXYZ.
I'm just picturing, you know, the Sears counter mobbed on Christmas Eve, you know, the disappointment on their face. They paw through them. Where is I?
Yeah, right. Rita Dorr finds the handkerchief counter so stressful and exhausting. And after a few days, she has enough material to write an article. So she tries to quit on the Saturday before Christmas. And I think Christmas is like Thursday or something like that of the following week. Her boss is like, you can't quit. Basically guilts her into staying. Oh, we have all the, you know, the people you work with, they're going to be so, you think it's bad now, just wait till Christmas Eve and you're going to leave them. We can't get a new person.
Wait, so Christmas Eve is really bad.
Christmas Eve is a nightmare.
Handkerchief hell.
Handkerchief hell. On Christmas Eve, people work from like 9 in the morning till midnight.
Really? The stores open till midnight?
The stores are open till, I think, 11 would be typical.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely insane. Our picture of what is a crowded store or even a crowded sidewalk is nothing compared to a picture. You would have to go to China to find sidewalks as crowded as in 19th century Chicago or New York, where this is. So she writes about Christmas Eve and describes how, you know, by the end of the day, there were just like boxes thrown behind the counter and handkerchiefs of every sort were like mixed up with each other. It's just awful. And the customers were really demanding and impatient and because they're all stressed out, too. And she concludes, I never respected any group of people more than I did my colleagues behind the handkerchief counter.
These unsung heroes of modernity.
The unsung heroes of modernity. And the handkerchief counter, this is not one of those things where people are only buying them for Christmas presents. That's why they put it on the first floor.
Right.
Is it's a big department year round, but it remains as a gift item into the 20th century from older people. So when I was a kid, my grandmother bought regular cotton handkerchiefs and embroidered Virginia on them and gave them to me because the assumption was, you know, I would need a handkerchief.
I was talking with a friend of mine about this episode. And he, you know, we were joking about it. And then he called me back 10 later. He had just had this memory when he was 13. And so this would have been 1968, 69, something like that. His grandfather presented him with a monogrammed handkerchief. And it was like, now you are a man, my son. And so he's like a typical 13-year-old in Ohio. And he looks at this and he just has no idea what to do. It's completely blank.
Right.
So what this is, I mean, it's kind of funny. I can imagine this, but this shows an extraordinary transition.
It's an extraordinary transition. My father, who was born in 1934, always carried a handkerchief. Well, you never know when you might need a handkerchief. And it was very neatly folded, and there's a very particular way, which I learned as a child, to iron a handkerchief so that you get this nice little square that can open up.
Yeah.
So it did continue, but it was a remnant of what had gone before.
You're like one of the last people who knows about sort of handkerchief management.
A little bit. The other thing I think is worth talking about, which is not directly about blowing your nose, is handkerchiefs as swag.
Oh, right.
So printed handkerchiefs were a thing. And bandanas, which are printed handkerchiefs, are very popular political campaign items.
Well, it's, you know, the best part about swag is when it's potentially kind of maybe useful.
Right.
That's why you're always getting like notepads.
Right.
Like
so
that.
This is sort of like if you give somebody a tote bag of the, you know, the Trader Joe's tote bag is now very popular and they don't actually give it away, but it's an ad.
Right.
And swag and useful. So handkerchiefs / bandanas are a thing in political causes. There are abolitionist handkerchiefs. There are generals of the Confederacy handkerchiefs. There's George Washington handkerchiefs, various things. But different causes have handkerchiefs, and political campaigns are particularly popular. Going back at least as far as William Henry Harrison, I've found imprints. So that's Tippecanoe and Tyler, too.
Right.
He's the guy who only lived you know, a month.
And,
very, that's early 19th century. But the most famous political campaign to use handkerchiefs or bandanas was Teddy Roosevelt.
Oh, right.
Because he was actually known in his Rough Rider days for wearing a bandana. So you can get, and I have here, a TR campaign bandana that shows TR wearing a bandana. It's sort of meta. It's pretty cool.
It's this sort of deep red color. And there's these around the edge is Teddy Roosevelt with the, you know, with the glasses and the mustache and the hat and the bandana, all of which are his signatures, right?
And if you look at this bandana carefully, what you realize is that the whole design of the bandana is one print, which would have been done with roller printing, like was printing newspapers. It was originally produced as yardage with at least two, however many yards you thought you were going to sell.
The point is, this is very clearly a mass industrial process.
It's a mass industrial process. And then it's cut and the hems are sewn up. In this case, they're clearly sewn by machine, which probably was the case in the day. And then I also have a fancier one, which is silk.
Ooh.
And it has a bull moose in the middle.
So that's from 1912.
So that's from 1912 when he runs as an independent. I'm not sure when the other one is used from. And it's a little bit smaller. And it's in some ways more bandana-y. That has a more geometrical kind of swirly prints. But it has the bull moose in each corner. So this you kind of have to, those who know what that stands for, which is probably everybody because it's in the mass media. But so you get bandanas as swag.
Right.
They're a presence. They're major departments in department stores. And then
all this collapses.
All this collapses. And the beginning of the end is World War I. You know, when there's a war, you need a lot of bandages and surgical dressings. And Kimberly Clark, which was a big paper manufacturer in the Midwest, they open a research lab and they hire this actually Austrian guy, so it's Ernst Mahler. They hired him before the war, and they're very patriotic. They make a point of this: don't suspect our guy. So they hire this research guy who develops a way of treating and fluffing the cellulose fiber that's used for paper to create something that they name cellucotton, designed to be a substitute for cotton bandages and cotton surgical dressing. Cotton has gotten expensive.
Okay.
It's gotten expensive because the boll weevil is eating the cotton crops.
Oh, right. So we should probably say very briefly what the boll
weevil is. The boll weevil is
an
insect that bores into the cotton plants before they sprout the cotton and it kills it. And it's a major pest.
At this time, agriculture is a much more important part of the economy than it is now. And so when you have this pest that's causing the collapse of a major agricultural product in the Southeast, it's causing enormous hardship.
And there's
massive campaigns against it.
It's a little bit later, but there are blues songs about the boll weevil.
Right.
The boll weevil is a big deal.
Right.
And so this cellucotton surgical dressing bandages, they're like 60% cheaper than cotton.
Oh, wow.
So this new product is great. And even better, Kimberly Clark, wanting to show how patriotic they are, they sell it to the Red Cross and the Department of War at cost.
Right.
So this is not cost plus, it's just cost.
Right.
And then after the war, the Red Cross just gives all of their cotton bandages, their cellucotton bandages, they just give them to hospitals. They flood the market. The War Department stops buying the stuff, and Kimberly Clark is left with inventories of this material. It's not necessarily made into bandages, but they have the material, the cellucotton, and no good way to sell it because there's a glut on the market for the bandages and surgical dressings originally designed. So they're going like, okay, what can we do with this material? We actually think it's very promising. We don't want to just, one possibility is just to leave that business and go make back to making newsprint. But that market wasn't really great, and this one they thought was promising. So the first idea, which is a whole story in itself, so I'll just briefly mention this. 1921, they take an idea from, I believe, French, but nurses on the front lines, which is they slightly redesign what they've done with bandages and turn them into Kotex. This is a huge development in itself. It's the first disposable sanitary napkin. Before that, women had their periods. They would just have cloth and laundry and stuff. And the nurses had thought, this is really good. And that's the whole story. How do you promote a new but unmentionable product?
Really a liberatory technology.
Yes, it's hugely liberatory. And in fact, aside, but one of the things that happens is there's a debate inside the company and the ad agency of whether you can advertise this product.
Right.
But if you can't advertise it, it's going to be really hard to sell.
Right.
And there's a woman who's like a secretary at the ad agency, and her boss says to the guy from Kimberly-Clark, well, I'm going to show it to her, and if she's shocked and appalled, you know, no go. But if and they show it to her, and she's like, oh, I think this is the best thing ever. So that is in 1921 that goes on the market. They start thinking, like, what else can we make with this product? And they come up with the idea, well, another thing that's happening with women, because 20s is this huge, major period of women's liberation.
Right. So you just got the vote.
Right.
All this sort of, there's now these young, independent women.
Right. And also, it's a big period. This is the first huge period of the movies.
Oh, right.
And those sort of combinations of things lead to women wearing, respectable women wearing makeup. People like my grandmother, who got married in 1927, always, you know, was nicely made up before it was associated with actresses and prostitutes, you know, and a respectable woman wouldn't wear makeup. By the 20s, this has changed and women are wearing makeup. And the way they take their makeup off at night is they use cold cream, particularly Pond's cold cream, because this is also an early period of branded advertising.
Right. That is really interesting. So your great grandmother, so to speak, would not have worn makeup, but your grandmother
certainly
might.
Not in her youth.
So there's a big shift.
And women are taking their makeup off with cold cream at night, and there would be like this dedicated towel in the bathroom that was the cold cream towel, and it would be sort of greasy and
would touch it.
In between, well, not only that, it was like in between laundering. Say you're doing laundry once a week. And you're wiping your face with cold cream every night.
Oh, wow.
You know, it starts because it's greasy. And so the folks at Kimberly-Clark say, why don't we take advantage of this cold cream removal? And we'll make a little paper sheets of this cellulose cotton, and we'll sell it as a substitute for this disgusting cold cream towel.
Right.
They do that, and they market Kleenex. And it's originally sold. It goes on the market in 1924, so it's just a little bit over 100 years old. And it goes on the market not as a substitute for handkerchiefs,
right,
but as the modern and sanitary and hygienic and neat way to remove your cold cream, to remove your makeup.
Right.
But very shortly, people start to realize, and one story is that Ernst Mahler, the head of research, had hay fever, and he started using these to blow his nose. But pretty quickly, they realize that people are using the Kleenex as a substitute for handkerchiefs.
Did this blindside the handkerchief industry? I mean, was this like a sudden assault on it?
Yes and no. So first, Kimberly-Clark advertises it. You'll see an ad, and 80% of the ad will be about cold cream. And the picture will be a woman wiping her face with a tissue. And then there'll be a little part in the corner that we'll talk about using it as a substitute for a handkerchief. And this would be, say, I don't know, 1926, so 2 years after the introduction. Very shortly, and certainly by 1930, you start to see the ads are dedicated specifically to Kleenex as a handkerchief substitute. And they start off, they're very kind of, I don't know, demure or understated, and it tells you the advantages. It saves unpleasant laundry, and is far pleasanter to use than handkerchiefs. Each time you use a fresh, clean, soft tissue, then discard it. Thus, coal germs are discarded instead of being carried around in pocket or purse, like the Indians would have told you was disgusting.
Finally, they catch up.
So that's the pitch. It's pleasanter.
I assume it's cheaper. Is that true?
It sort of depends on how you look at it. Because, you know, you're reusing the handkerchiefs and so how many uses you, but it is an affordable product.
Right.
But it's more expensive in real terms than it is today, because over time gets cheaper and cheaper and cheaper.
Is it actually better?
But it's better.
Okay.
It's better both in the way that they describe here, which is that you don't carry it around. And remember this, don't carry around your dirty tissues in your pocket. The advantage of them is that you don't have to.
Right.
But so that sanitary aspect is better.
Right.
And the other thing is, it's actually more absorbent than many handkerchiefs, maybe not every handkerchief, but it contains the liquid better, and then you get rid of it. So this combination is a big advantage of that. And so by the 1930s, you start to see much blunter ads. A Kleenex ad will show the woman holding the tissue up near her nose as though she's about to sneeze.
Right.
So it's not disgusting.
When do Kleenexes replace handkerchiefs?
That's a really good question. You can today buy a handkerchief,
right,
not just a pocket square, but a handkerchief for blowing your nose. It's really by the time that your friend in 1968 is looking at this handkerchief that his grandfather gives him as "Today I am a man," and going, huh, that's really the period where handkerchiefs are still around, but probably not selling a whole lot of new ones. And it's worth mentioning that in the period of handkerchief dominance of pre-World War I, laundry was also a lot more onerous, which meant laundering handkerchiefs was much more disgusting than onerous. We have an episode on laundry, so I don't want to go into all the details about doing laundry, but suffice it to say that it was often involved boiling water on the stove and washing by hand and hanging on a line and all of that. So part of what disposable tissues did was, if you didn't have a modern washing machine, it took that part out of of laundry away from you. In the post-World War II period, Kleenex becomes this hugely dominant brand, and people use tissues for blowing their nose.
Right.
Over time, eventually, Procter & Gamble finds a place in the market. They introduce Puffs, and those are the two major things. And Kimberly-Clark, which came up with this name Kleenex, has to protect its copyright so that we don't just call them all Kleenex.
Right. Also, you know, TB goes down, air pollution goes down. We have things like Sudafed. People don't have to blow their nose quite as much as they did, which is kind of great, actually. The fact that fewer people are walking around with this factory churning out stuff in their nose. So, you know, who knows? Maybe if we actually come up with a cure for the common cold and so forth, you know, maybe the Kleenex will go away.
But it's worth noting that, you know, people talk about disposable products often in a negative sense, even though they use them all. And the idea that Kleenex was one of the earliest disposable products following Kotex, it's probably a disposable product that most of us would not like to go live without. Thank you for joining us for Everyday Abundance. This podcast is sponsored by the Abundance Institute, and you can find all the episodes and show notes on their website at abundance.institute. Very easy to remember. Also easy to remember is our YouTube channel, Everyday-Abundance. Please subscribe. You can also find episodes wherever you get podcasts. Our producer is Toby Murashanu, and the music was written and performed by John Harden.
If you like this and want to support us, the most important thing you can do is actually leave a review. And this matters in ways that the gods of the algorithm are best able to explain.